You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, food insecurity in Canada, it is widespread, and Eugene Debs, trailblazing American union leader and socialist radical, inspiration for New York City's new Democratic Socialist mayor, Zohran Mamdani, and for Democratic Socialists up, down, and across North America. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. First news headlines from GPM contributor Kylie Wong.
A quarter of Canadians struggle with food insecurity. That's the key conclusion of a December 2024 report from Statistics Canada. About 10 million Canadian households are food insecure, Stats Canada says. Once associated with deep poverty, food insecurity in Canada is now widespread. As of 2019, Nunavut had the highest rate of food insecurity, with the Northwest Territories and Yukon a close second and third, the Stats Canada report says. According to Neil Hetherington, the CEO of Daily Bread Food Bank, most Canadians seeking help from food banks are between ages 18 to 44. About 60% have a post-secondary degree, and 50% are fully employed. More on this in today's GPM edition. Income is the key determinant of food security, experts say. On October 1, 2025, minimum wage increased in Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island. Other provinces and territories adjusted their minimum wage earlier this year. According to the Retail Council of Canada, Nunavut had the highest minimum wage at $19.75. Alberta has the lowest at $15. Despite these increases, there is still a large gap between minimum wage and living wage. In 2024, the Ontario Living Wage Network put the living wage for the Greater Toronto Area at $26 per hour, while Ontario's minimum wage is only $17.60 per hour. On Saturday, January 3rd, U.S. military forces abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, spiriting them to the U.S. to be prosecuted for a variety of alleged crimes. The international community has responded in a variety of ways. Writing on X, the social media channel controlled by U.S. billionaire Elon Musk, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney wrote, quote, Canada has not recognized the illegitimate regime of Maduro since it stole Venezuela's 2018 election. The Canadian government therefore welcomes the opportunity for freedom, democracy, peace, and prosperity for the Venezuelan people. Carney called on all parties to respect international law. Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre was more upbeat about Maduro's abduction. Quote, congratulations, President Trump, on successfully arresting narco-terrorist and socialist dictator Nicolas Maduro, who should live out his days in prison. Down with socialism, long live freedom. Interim New Democratic Party leader Don Davies wrote on X, the U.S. attack on Venezuela is neither an act of self-defense nor does it have U.N. Security Council authorization. It is therefore totally illegal and a breach of the U.N. covenants the U.S. has agreed to uphold as a member of state. Bloc Québécois leader Yves-François Blanchet wrote, the Bloc Québécois acknowledges that the regime established in Venezuela by Nicolas Maduro defies fundamental freedoms, integrity, and democracy, and is the subject of allegations of involvement in drug trafficking. However, it is deeply troubling to us that the United States is positioning itself as the guardian of these principles, risking the violation of international law, particularly by resorting to military force at the peril of civilian lives and by detaining a head of state, even an illegitimate one. In response to the seizure and abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife by U.S. military forces, former Green Party Deputy Leader Mike Morris said, we can't stand by while one man's insatiable and violent thirst for oil makes an already perilous time in the world even less safe and even more unstable. That's just some of this week's news for the Green Planet Monitor.
Thanks, Kylie.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. Kylie's report, 1 in 4 Canadians live in households experiencing food insecurity. That's the finding of a report from Statistics Canada released last November. Over the last 5 years, the rate of severe food insecurity, Canadians actually not eating, has doubled. Food insecurity is highest in Nunavut. 60 to 70% of households there experience it. It's the lowest in Quebec. For insight into the nature and origin of food insecurity in Canada, the GPM reached out to Valerie Tarasuk, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto. Tarasuk is the coordinator of PROOF, a research program that explores policy interventions to reduce food insecurity in Canada. Can you talk about this? What is the status of food insecurity in Canada? To what degree do we see food insecurity and hunger in Canada? Is it comparable to the United States? Not that the United States is just an interesting benchmark because they're south of the border. What's the status of food insecurity in Canada?
So a couple of things to say. First of all, while we use the same metric, we use the same questionnaire to assess food insecurity in Canada as they do in the United States, but we code the questions differently. So these statistics on food insecurity, it's quite tricky, right? Because they look like they're all telling you the same thing. This is the, you know, number of people who are food insecure. But because of these subtle differences in the way that different countries handle the actual, you know, coding and interpretation of that measurement, we end up with different results. So we can't compare directly the percentages that you've cited from the US with those from Canada because we're using the codes differently. So to explain a bit more about what I'm meaning, back in the 90s, the United States Department of Agriculture developed a very thoughtful, very clever measure of food insecurity. It's 18 questions that range in severity from worrying about running out of food and not having money to buy more, through to compromises in the quality of what adults eat or the quality of what children eat, and then through to a whole bunch of questions about quantitative deprivation. So people skipping meals, going hungry without eating, going whole days without eating at most extreme cases, all because of a lack of money for food. So 18 questions. And those questions are brilliant from a measurement perspective because they're designed to assess food insecurity almost like a thermometer. So with each additional affirmative answer on those 18, we know that the household is in a more severe condition, right?
And so the idea is that food insecurity depends on how you define food insecurity, but it kind of exists across a very wide spectrum.
That's right. And there's a continuum of severity. And from a health and well-being perspective, obviously those who are in more extreme conditions are in worse shape. Okay, so that's the measurement tool. Imagine, you know, 18 points on a yardstick, and when it was first developed, it was developed in the United States, and it from the get-go was of interest because of the links between the levels of food insecurity in the country and the success or the efficiency of the publicly funded food assistance programs in that country. So SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Program that used to be called food stamps, but also things like WIC and other initiatives that were designed to provide nutrition to vulnerable groups in the population. Okay, so you know, you have a choice with those 18 questions. At what point do you claim someone's food insecure? Do you say any answer is an indication, or do you need them to answer 2 or 3? And so the U.S., you know, wanting a conservative measure because, you know, this is a terrible problem and you don't want the problem to appear bigger than it really is. So from the beginning, the U.S., you know, insisted that people have at least 2 or more, or possibly 3 or more affirmatives before they were considered food insecure. Over time in Canada, we came to understand that if you said yes to any one of those questions, you were different than somebody who said no to all of them. And even somebody who said they were worrying about running out of food before they had money for more was different than someone like me who would never say yes to that because I wouldn't worry about that. So in Canada, we started counting anybody who said anything yes. So Then we started to, you know, when Canada adopted the module, we adopted it in 2005, so a long time ago. But we started then also to rethink the coding of the module and how the questions about children were handled versus adults. So, you know, it's like any area of science, right? Over time, things have evolved in terms of the measurement. But the U.S. their public releases have kept with a very conservative estimate of food insecurity, and they've done that for obvious reasons. Whereas in Canada, because our measurement of food insecurity sadly isn't tied to any political decisions, we've been less worried about a conservative estimate. So over time, in the beginning, when Canada first started using this module, the prevalence of food insecurity in Canada, when we would take the data from both countries and reanalyze it using comparative metrics so that we had actual, you know, we were comparing apples with apples. When we did that in the beginning, Canada looked way better. Prevalence of food insecurity that was, I don't know, half or two-thirds that of the U.S. So we looked like we were doing way better. That's not true anymore. The most recent year that we did a calculation of the comparable numbers was, I think, 2022, and we're neck and neck. So the situation in Canada has gotten worse. We are not doing better than the United States. We're also not doing worse. It looks like the two countries are very comparable right now.
And that number was, in 2022, was 17.8% of those surveyed, or of the country, faced some degree of food insecurity.
And I can give you a number that it dates to 2024, so a more recent number, because the rate has increased considerably. In 2024, 25.5% of Canadians lived in a household that experienced some level of food insecurity. 25%. So we've seen a dramatic rise over the last few years.
And that would range from worries that you're not going to have enough money in your bank account to buy food at the end of the month or at the very beginning of the month after you've paid your rent, versus people who are actually skipping meals and they're hungry.
That's right. And all of those conditions have gone up. Over the last 5 years, we've seen a doubling in the number of people living in severe food insecurity. Severe food insecurity are people who said yes to enough of those 18 questions that we've reason to believe people in those households actually went without eating because of a lack of food and money for food. So yeah, this is a very dire situation.
So I want to ask why. Why is this the situation, which is a complex question to answer? But the other question is, how widely distributed is this? Do we see this evenly distributed across Canada, or is it, you know, focalized in inner cities or in rural areas? How widespread and how evenly distributed is food insecurity, and why is there food insecurity? And I mean, you could talk for 2 hours about this.
That's right. It's every province, every part of every territory, every part of this country has substantial rates of food insecurity. So no place is immune from this. Over the years that this problem has been measured, the rates are highest in Nunavut, much, much higher there. Depending on which survey you look at, you could see rates as high as 60 or 70%. So over half of the population in Nunavut appears to be living in food insecure situations. And so that is the extreme, you know, worst picture in the country. But it's like tragic, right? Because from the very beginning, when this survey started back in 2005, when they started surveying people in Nunavut, they were always finding much, much higher. I say they, these surveys are conducted by Statistics Canada. Always there were much, much higher rates of food insecurity in Nunavut. And what's happened over the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, those numbers have gotten worse. So that's the worst situation. The best situation, for the last few years, we've noticed lower rates of food insecurity in Quebec. And that's been interesting because in the beginning, Quebec didn't really distinguish itself from Ontario, for example. But in the last few years, Quebec has looked distinctly different. The suspicion is that we've got different social policies in Quebec compared to other places. And I think that makes good sense, right? I told you that over the country as a whole, the proportion of people living in food insecure situations was 25.5%. So in Ontario, it was 26.4. In Quebec, it was 19.8. Oh. So what have we got there? Like a 6-7 percentage point gap. that's illustrative of the contrast with Quebec. That there's this, as you know, Quebec is hardly doing well, right? At 19, what, almost 20%, but still substantially better than Ontario. How come? Well, I have a very, very talented research associate working with me who is originally from Quebec, Andréanne Fafard-Saint-Germain, and she has recently done a study trying to figure this out, comparing Ontario and Quebec over time to say what's going on. And what she's, and so that paper is coming out. It isn't out in the public domain yet, but what she's found is that there's no one thing. It's not like if we look at the difference between Ontario and Quebec, it's all about single parents, or it's all about single people, or it's, you know, we're not seeing that. It looks like it's across the board. And the implication is that there are an array of social policies in Quebec that insulate people from food insecurity. We know they have more generous childcare policies, they have more generous child benefits, they have a lower cost of living. Part of what's been, I think, driving a lot of the really dramatic increase in the number over the last few years has been inflation and the cost of basic needs. And in Quebec, the cost of basic goods and services is on average lower than it is, for example, in Ontario. And again, that would speak to public policy in some ways. It looks like conditions are leaner and meaner in Ontario than they are in Quebec, and that over time, economic conditions have shifted. It looks like Quebecers have been better supported to manage, you know, rising prices and hardship than people in other parts of Canada. But notably, Quebec has also lost ground through this inflationary period.
And food prices are really, really high, and they've been going up.
I mean, food insecurity is about people not having enough money for food. So, and that's ultimately about them not having enough money. And so, the extent to which this is specific to food prices, I think, for me at least, in Canada, is an open question. If we look at household budgets, most of the household budget isn't spent on food, it's spent on housing. The single biggest budget item in any, whether you're high income or low income, the single biggest budget line typically is shelter. So, yes, food prices have gone up, but what's, I think, significant for people who are food insecure or at risk of food insecurity is that we've also seen significant increases in shelter costs. Utilities, but also rents, have increased dramatically, right? So, yes, and I mean, in time, I think we'll maybe have a better handle on the extent to which the recent increases have been driven by food price inflation. But our earlier work did not suggest that this was specific to changes in food prices so much as it was to changes overall in the cost of living. And related to that, the extent to which wages and benefits are indexed to cost of living, right? Because that's the other side of cost of living. When costs rise, for most of us, our incomes also rise. We've got all kinds of policies in place that index things like old age security and the Canada Child Benefit that index them to inflation. So when prices rise, incomes rise. But not everybody's incomes rise as well. And so it's one thing to go to the store and notice, gee whiz, the price of milk has really jumped, or the price of eggs, it keeps going up. And yes, absolutely. And that makes, you know, that means you've got to find more money in your purse for those things. But when it comes to a population-wide problem like food insecurity, we've got to step back and say, okay, how does that price of eggs, you know, relate to what's in that purse? And how does what's in that purse relate to decisions at the provincial and federal level?
And then there's quote unquote healthy food and there's unhealthy food. There are food products that are packaged and canned and filled with salt and sugar and I suppose are relatively cheap, although I'm not certain that that's the case, versus foods that are, you know, whole foods, grains and fresh produce that aren't that isn't packaged, the greens, leafy greens. How do the prices of these two broad classes of food commodities compare? You know, inexpensive bad food, quote unquote, versus the healthy food. Because if you've only got so much money in your pocket, you're going to go out and choose the cheapest food, and this may not be the best yield the best health outcomes.
Yeah, but Yes, all true. But we have a real problem in Canada and in the US and elsewhere with people who aren't food insecure overconsuming those unhealthy foods, right? I mean, processed foods are a big issue in terms of the health of Canadians. And absolutely, if we look at the statistics or the data on dietary intakes in Canada, we can see that people living in food insecure situations are likely, they have on average a higher proportion of their diet comes from highly processed foods, which undoubtedly relates to the price of those foods relative to other things. But honestly, those differences are small. Yes, we can get statistically significant differences when we compare, consumption of ultra-processed foods by food insecurity status, but we have very, very high levels of consumption amongst people that are food secure. So it's, yes, undoubtedly someone who's resource constrained will be forced to make decisions to, maximize their what they purchase based on, trying to meet their energy needs, their calorie needs, and therefore having to, forfeit healthier options. But that's only part of the story. And in Canada, we have a very, very big problem of, Canadians not making healthy choices, irrespective of their incomes.
And I was going to ask you, what are the public health consequences of food insecurity in terms of national morbidity and mortality rates?
We've done those studies. We've looked at food insecurity in relationship to, health administrative data, so hospitalizations, mortality statistics, emergency department visits. And across the spectrum, we can see higher rates of healthcare usage among people in family in households that are food insecure versus food secure. And in those studies, we can always see a gradient whereby the more severe the household food insecurity, the higher the probability of using healthcare services over a 12-month period. And the if it's, for example, hospitalizations, if you're in a, the more severe the household food insecurity, the greater the likelihood that adults will be admitted to hospital and the greater the likelihood that they will stay longer or that and that they will be readmitted if through that 12-month period. When we then strip away that part and say, okay, what are they being admitted for? What are they in hospital for? We can then see a really strong effect of a really strong association between food insecurity and mental health problems. But we also can see higher probability of admissions for metabolic, cardiometabolic conditions, for musculoskeletal injuries, like all kinds of things. It's not specific to diet-related conditions. It's across the spectrum. When we look at when we look at mortality, same thing. Canadians who are in food insecure situations are more likely to die younger than those who are food secure. And again, there's this profound effect of the severity of the food insecurity. So one study that we did a few years ago, we found that adults in severely food insecure households who died in the, I think we had a 12-year period of follow-up, on average, were dying 9 years earlier than somebody who was food secure who died over that period. And like suicide was way more likely to be a cause of death amongst adults from severely food insecure households than it was for other adults. So we're seeing again that the mental health effects are real, and they span the gamut to the point where we're seeing suicide as a significant distinction, as a cause of death between people in food secure versus food insecure situations. And of course, as you'd expect, cardiometabolic issues.
What policy interventions do you and your colleagues put forward to address the problem of food insecurity in Canada? And I'm wondering, just related to that, what your thoughts are on Zora Mamdani's promise to set up publicly funded grocery stores in New York City. It'll be interesting to see how that comes about and how that works exactly.
Well, it's a good question. Our work all points to the need for policy interventions that impact income. So we have not, it, there have been many studies done over the years. I mean, we've been monitoring this problem since 2005, so 20 years of data. These are large Statistics Canada surveys, so, 50,000 households being surveyed per year. We've got tons and tons of data to be able to analyze the effects of changes in public policy, both federally and provincially. And over again, when studies are done looking at changes in policy, always the effects that are significant are those where incomes have changed. If we see an increase in child benefits, if we see an increase in social assistance benefits, increases in minimum wage, all of those things play out in terms of food insecurity.
Canada needs a guaranteed income.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All of this, well, and the best argument for a guaranteed income in Canada is the story of seniors. You asked me earlier, is this problem evenly dispersed? Is it everywhere, right? And I'm saying, well, yeah, it is. Okay. But over and over again, and this has been true for since we started getting population-level data on food insecurity in Canada, over and over again, we see that the one group who have a much lower rate of food insecurity than everybody else, a much lower probability of being food insecure, are seniors. And from the get-go, from as long as I've been a researcher in this area, if you turn 65, the chances are your probability of food insecurity is much lower than other people. When you turn 65, it doesn't matter how you spent the last 65 years, if you're a Canadian, you are now entitled to old age security. And if you're a low-income Canadian, if that's the only income you've got at 65, you also are eligible for the guaranteed income supplement. Okay, so let's just talk about those for a minute. Indexed to inflation, they come with full pharmacare, so you will never have to worry about being able to afford prescriptions, which is a big issue for people who are food insecure. But also, let's talk about the amount of money you're getting. If you were on welfare in Ontario, what's called Ontario Works, ironically, welfare in Ontario, and you're a single person and you turn 65, you know what? And now you shift from Ontario Works to old age security and the guaranteed income supplement, your income will more than double overnight. And all that's happened is you had a birthday. But what a birthday you had, because suddenly you have income security for the rest of your life. It is indexed to inflation. It's more than double welfare. And you're going to have a very low probability of food insecurity.
So, last question, moving to the end of our conversation. Thank you so much for your time. What are the prospects for lowering the prevalence of food insecurity? What needs to happen? I mean, incomes have to increase. It's all got to do with income.
I think we've hit a crisis point. The reason we've got so many people living in food insecure situations now is that for too long, governments have not kept their eye on that ball. They've done everything else, but they haven't done that. And if you look at the most recent federal budget, there's all kinds of thought in there about initiatives that Canada needs. But there isn't anything in there that's tackling directly the adequacy of incomes for lower income Canadians. To have one in four Canadians living in conditions like this is not good. It manifests, as we've talked about in this conversation, it manifests in healthcare utilization. So it is a drain on our healthcare budgets. It also impacts productivity. It is running counter to all of the goals that Canada should have right now in terms of becoming a leaner, meaner, more competitive nation, a more productive nation. We've also got outcries from communities across the country where, food banks and other frontline responders are overwhelmed with demands for a food charity right now because we've got so many people in such dire circumstances. We've got the federal government now moving into the domain of school food programs, ostensibly to try to help, prevent the number of hungry children in schools. Like, we got many signals that there is a real problem in our country with too many people not being able to afford what they need. We know food charity isn't going to fix this problem. And if we didn't know it, all we have to do is listen to the leaders in the food bank movement, and they tell us exactly that, right? They're all calling for public policy reforms. So I think at the end of the day, we can't keep going like this. We have no choice. It's a drain on our healthcare system. It's a drain on the functioning of our society. We can't fix it with little bits and bats of food charity. We can see that by the exponential rise in these numbers. So I think we're going to have to get back to basics. The only question is how long it takes for our federal and provincial governments to come in line on that.
Valerie Tarasuk is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto and the coordinator of PROOF, a research program aimed at